Blog Talk Radio.
To another episode of Crime and Science Radio. Today's show is called Chasing Monsters, Running from Monsters, an interview with Douglas Preston, best-selling author of The Monster of Florence. So now, without any further ado, here are your hosts of the show, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Thanks, John. I want to welcome everyone to this edition of Crime and Science Radio. We have a very special guest today, Douglas Preston, one of the founding members of International Thriller Writers. He's published only 28 books in his life, both fiction and nonfiction, and several have been New York Times bestsellers. He also writes for the New Yorker magazine and taught nonfiction writing at Princeton University. His most recent nonfiction book, and we're going to talk a little bit about it today, is The Monster of Florence, and I think it's going to be made into a movie pretty soon. He's also the co-creator with Lincoln Child of the Agent Pendergast series of novels, which are wonderful novels. Doug, welcome to the show.
Well, it's good to be here.
Good to be anywhere, isn't it? You grew up in Wellesley, Massachusetts, and in your bio you mentioned that you and your brothers Richard and David built rockets in your backyard. And a kid that grew up in Huntsville, Alabama, the Marshall Space Flight Center, all of us built rockets in the backyard. So I have to ask you before we get into this, is what was your best rocket and how far did it go?
Oh, wow, what a question. well, I'll tell you, Wellesley was a very conservative town. And this, of course, was during the Cold War. So my two brothers and I decided we were going to send a rocket over Wellesley Square, which would, so we're going to shoot it off at an angle so that when it ran out of fuel, the parachute would drop the rocket down into Wellesley Square. And we were going to terrify everybody by covering the rocket with Russian letters. So we got a book and we copied all these Russian letters and we took a piece of paper and put it in the payload with all these Russian letters and we thought we were going to terrify the town into thinking that the Russians were bombing them. So there was this hill about a half a mile from Wellesley Square. So we got up on this hill and we set off this rocket at an angle, which you never are supposed to do. Unfortunately, we had mixed up the second and the third stages. And if you're a rocket enthusiast, you know that the final stage has a 5-second delay before it fires.
Yeah.
So this rocket went up and was going beautifully, but the second stage suddenly stopped, and the rocket then ended up pointing straight down at the ground, and then the third stage went off. And so it fired the rocket at incredibly high speed towards the ground, and not in Wellesley Square, but in, maybe a quarter of a mile away in this suburban leafy neighborhood. And we heard this guy, there was like the sound of a lawnmower down there. And we saw this rocket shooting into the ground, flashing down. And then the lawnmower cut off. And we thought, oh, my God, we've killed some poor guy mowing his lawn. So we got on our bikes and we kind of were riding through the neighborhood sort of looking to see. And here's this guy mowing his lawn, and we stopped and said, "Say, have you seen a rocket?" He said, "Yeah, I seen that rocket. God damn it, it nearly killed me. Jesus." He said, "You want your rocket? It's over there in the garbage can, and you kids are lucky I didn't call the police." So we retrieved this completely mangled rocket out of the garbage can, and that was the end of our adventure trying to terrorize Wellesley into thinking the Russians were coming.
After you gave up on being a rocket scientist, you came out to California at Pomona College and you got a degree in English literature. And then you worked as a writer and editor and a manager of publications for the American Museum of Natural History in New York. How did you end up there and what was that job all about?
Well, I wanted to be a science writer, you know, a science journalist. And so I got this, I got a degree in English literature from Pomona, but I also took all these classes in calculus and chemistry and physics and everything else, so I'd have a background so I could write about it. And then I got this job at the Museum of Natural History. Basically, I was answering phones and writing, you know, writing for their throwaway newsletter. And I'd spent 8 years there, and it was the most fascinating place. I mean, it was so, it's one of the largest museums in the world, and 98% of their collections are not on display. They're stuck in these storage rooms, you know, just huge museum. It's just gigantic. And of course, afterwards, many of my novels ended up being set in that museum. And of course, Lincoln and I murdered a number of people who worked for that museum. And and I eventually became a persona non grata in that museum because of it. But anyway.
Well, I'd love to hear also about how you ended up in Italy in the first place, but you became interested while you were there in the case of the Italian serial killer known as the Monster of Florence. Can you give us a thumbnail sketch of that case and tell us what drew you to it?
Well, that's an interesting story. You know, I'd always wanted to move my family to Italy, and, you know, since I'm a writer, I can work anywhere. And I had this, what I thought was a fantastic idea of a murder mystery set in Tuscany. This artist historian is murdered and his eyes are ripped out. His body's found by the road. So when I arrived in Florence, I thought, I've got to figure out what happens when the police find a dead body. You know, what do they do? I mean, I had to figure out the procedure. You know, this was going to be somewhat of a police procedural set in Italy. So someone said, you've got to talk to Mario Spezzi. He's the crime correspondent for La Nazione, which is the local paper. He knows more about how the police work than anyone else. So I had a meeting with Mario. We, you know, had coffee and, you know, an espresso, typical Italian thing. And my Italian at that time was very rudimentary, and his English was non-existent, basically. So he described to me what the police do when they find a dead body and all this stuff. And then I asked him, well, what are you working on? Well, he started telling me the story of a serial killer called the Monster of Florence, a case that he'd been covering for 15 years. And I was absolutely stunned. Well, actually, you know, I have to back up here a little bit. The reason he started telling me about this case was because he asked me where I was living, and I said, well, we rented this little villa just outside the city gates and in this little town called Giogoli. And he said, Giogoli, that's an interesting town. It has three famous landmarks. There's the villa designed by Michelangelo, and then there is the other villa where Prince Charles honeymooned with Princess Diana, and then there is right outside your front door that little olive grove. And I said, well, what about that olive grove? And he said, well, that was the site of one of the most horrific double homicides in Italian history.
Oh, my.
And I said, well, gee, you know, the real estate agent didn't tell us anything about that. But I said, well, what was this? And he started telling me about this serial killer who killed between 1974 and 1985. He roamed the beautiful hills, the Florentine hills around Florence, and he would kill young lovers in parked cars while they were making love. He would kill the man first, and then he would kill the woman, and then he would drag her out of the vehicle and perform a ritualistic, I'm not even sure if I can go into it on the radio, a mutilation, just horrifying thing. And he was never caught. He murdered 14 people, 11, you know, seven couples, and the case even today is still open. It's the longest and most expensive criminal investigation in Italian history, and he became known as the Monster of Florence. And it turns out that Mario Spezzi, the guy I was talking to, had covered these cases from the start, and had actually given the monster his name in one of the early newspaper articles that he wrote about it. And I said, my God, this is one of the most horrific stories I've ever heard. It's not one of the most, it is the most horrific story. I mean, this killer made Jack the Ripper look like, Mr. Rogers. I mean, he was just horrifying. So I said, listen, Mario, I completely forgot about my novel, and I never wrote that novel. It's never got written. And instead, I said, Mario, you and I should write an article about the monster of Florence. You know, I write for the New Yorker magazine. I said, we should write an article about this for the New Yorker magazine, and then we'll write a book about it. And so that's what became the Monster of Florence.
So, as you mentioned, the murders remained unsolved, but do you have your own ideas about it or your own top suspects in mind?
Well, we did. Not suspects, but a very prime suspect. And it's kind of funny. When we were writing the story for the New Yorker magazine, so Mario said, at a certain point, we were going through the case, and I'd go up to his house every day, and he'd lay out all this evidence. He's really teaching me this enormous amount of information about the case, laying out all the police files and the crime scene photographs and everything so that I could get the background I needed to write about the case with him. And he said, I know who the Monster of Florence is. He said, I know who it is. And I said, and then he proceeded to go through all the evidence, which was enormous, and I was completely shocked that this obvious suspect had not been arrested. I mean, they had arrested all these people. The way the monster operated was he would kill, and then he would wait, and the police would arrest somebody, and as soon as they arrested somebody, he would kill again. And so the police were humiliated and had to release that person. And then, another 6 months would go by, the police would arrest somebody else, and then the monster would kill again. He was sort of humiliating the police. So anyway, Mario said, I know who this person is. And so he laid out the evidence and it was extremely convincing. But Mario said, there's no way that we're going to interview this person. I don't want this person to have, I don't want any contact with this person. He said, I live in the area where this monster murdered people. I have a young daughter. I have a wife. It's not going to happen. So we submitted the article to the New Yorker magazine, and the editor called me up. She said, Doug, what is this? What is this? She was a very, foul-mouthed editor. She had a very blunt way of talking. She said, what is this crap? You write an article. I mean, this is good. Okay, it's good. But you say you know who the Monster of Florence is. Why have you not interviewed him? And I said, well, because he's a serial killer who murdered 14 people. And she said, and you call yourself a journalist? I mean, whoa. We have journalists being shot at in war zones, and you're afraid to interview some little serial killer in Tuscany, Italy? She said, what's the matter with you? You guys are chicken shit. You get in there, you interview him, and you ask him, are you the Monster of Florence? And I want that on tape, and that's, otherwise, this we can't use this article. So I told that to Mario, and he said, geez, I'm not going in there and, asking him that question. Well, I said, look, Mario, we have to. So he said, all right, I'm going to use a fake name. I said, Mario, we're journalists. We can't use a fake name. He said, I don't give a damn. We're in Italy, and I'm going to use a fake name. So we arrived at this guy's house at 10 o'clock at night, in the apartment, and to make sure he was at home, because we knew that we'd only have one shot at this. I mean, you can't, there's not going to be a second chance, and we didn't want to call ahead of time. So we just rang the buzzer. He buzzed us up, right up. Mario gave the fake name. I think Marco Tiezzi was what he called himself. We arrived in the apartment, and here is this guy who, completely confounded all my ideas of what a serial killer looked like. But the first thing he did was he looked at Mario and he said, "Wait, I must have misheard your name. You're Mario Spezzi. You're the guy who wrote all those articles about the monster of Florence. I've read everything you've written." So we sat down and we interviewed him, and eventually Mario did ask the question, "Are you the monster of Florence?" I'm afraid the answer is absolutely unrepeatable on the radio, but you'll have to read my book to find it.
Exactly.
But it was very chilling. It was definitely, without a doubt, the scariest interview I've ever conducted as a journalist.
Understandably. Now, the monster of Florence is heading to the big screen. What can you tell us about that?
Well, George Clooney bought the rights and is producing it, and is also says he's going to star in it. So
we'll keep our fingers crossed. That's great.
But no timeline or anything yet.
Well, these things move slowly.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm afraid. So I don't have any kind of timeline, but you know, maybe another couple of years.
Yeah. Well,
newlyweds, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Well, a lot of our listeners are obviously crime writers and thriller writers and all that, both true crime and novelistic crimes. But I know they'd be interested in how you approached your research for this and for your other books, because your books are always well researched in the scientific world. What besides this being a very, very cold case, with the murders happening many years before, and other things that you've researched, what's your basic process when you approach a project and you need to go gather information?
Well, the Monster of Florence was a completely different type of situation from my other books. Mario Spezzi, my partner in this, had a huge archive of information that he'd already gathered. So basically what my research consisted of was asking him, "All right, I need this, you know, can you find me that, you know, can you," you know, I also needed to interview people, not just the monster, but we interviewed the mother of one of the victims and a number of other people, police officers and so forth. So he was the one who sort of coordinated all that. It was difficult for me because it was in a foreign language. Nobody spoke English, and I'm reading all these documents in Italian and you know, their police jargon and so forth. I was immersed in Italian for 4 years, and it really was a great lesson in Italian, but it was, you know, quite challenging, since when I arrived in Italy, I was 44 years old and really barely spoke Italian at all. So I really had to learn the language quite fluently, and at an advanced age of 44, you know, you're practically senile when it comes to a new language. So, but I think I added so many brain cells, I'm going to live another 10 years before I reach my dotage. But as far as other research goes, I like to do my own research. I don't hire anyone to do research for me, because I often find that the thing I'm looking for, as I'm looking for it, I'll find something a lot better, sort of off to the side. But I love researching, and the books I write with Lincoln, I mean, Lincoln's like I am, we're both really into research, and so we often are researching the most arcane subjects. I know the book we're working on now, we are researching the Salem witch trials, and, you know, just really getting into that very deep, and also looking into witchcraft as a religion, not Wicca, you know,
right,
which is sort of a modern, you know, kind of New Age thing. But I mean, I'm talking about, you know, in the Middle Ages, how people really looked at witchcraft, and reading medieval treatises on how to discover witches, how to find them, how to uncover them, and then how to execute them, you know, how to question them, how to torture them. There are quite a lot written about that. So,
Well, while you and Mario were roaming around the countryside doing your research and interviewing people and stuff, things didn't go so well, did they? You had some problems with some of the Italian authorities, particularly one prosecutor.
Well, that's right. This case had gone on for so long, and the Italian, just many, many different, you know, police, you know, inspectors, you know, detectives had come and gone, and the case, they started thinking that the case was not a lone serial killer murdering young people for this kind of sick, libidinous reason, but that actually it was a medieval cult, or a cult dating back to the Middle Ages, that needed female body parts as the wafer for their blasphemous masses, black masses. Now this is the theory now about the Monster of Florence. This is a cult of a number of, you know, noblemen and high-placed people and so forth. A completely ridiculous and absurd theory that was not at all supported by the actual forensic, you know, evidence at the crime scene, which always indicated there was only one person. So Mario Spezzi went on national television. He's a very well-known reporter. So he went on this very, very high, well, it was actually one of the highest-rated shows in Italy, and he ridiculed the police theories of the crime and everything else. And the chief inspector in charge of the case is Sicilian. And, you know, he went on national television and ridiculed this man. And this man reacted. And, you know, first his goons broke into Mario's apartment and seized the computer and all his research and the draft of our book, everything, you know. And the only, Mario was able to save some of the crucial stuff by slipping a floppy disk into his underwear, and they searched him, but they didn't quite catch it. But I was really worried when that happened. I said, Mario, you know, they're going to come after me. And he said, don't worry, Doug, you're an American, you're a best-selling author in Italy, they're not going to come after you. And how wrong that was. One day I was walking through the streets of Florence, and my cell phone rang, and this voice, this very officious Italian voice, said, is this Mr. Preston? I said, yes. He said, well, this is the police. Where are you? We want to know exactly where you are because we are coming to get you. And this is how they arrest you in Italy. They call your cell phone and ask you where you are. So I said, well, what if I don't tell you? And they said, Mr. Preston, it would be not a good thing if we had to find you. Just tell us where you are. It's obbligatorio. So they came and they got me and they hauled me in for an interrogation in front of this very powerful prosecutor, this fellow named Mignini. And, you know, an interrogation in Italian, no lawyer, no interpreter. I mean, it was really terrifying. They questioned me for 3 hours and accused me of being an accessory to murder and all these other heinous crimes. So it was quite frightening.
Fun. You ended up in an interrogation box with those guys, too.
Well, they did. They, you know, there's no Fifth Amendment in Italy. So what they said to me was, if you don't confess to these crimes right now, we are going to charge you with perjury. Or the Italians have a name for this type of perjury. It's called reticenza, which means reticence. It sounds nice, but actually reticence means you're not telling them what you know. And if you don't tell them what you know, that is a felony. It's a very serious type of perjury. You know, so the prosecutor was saying to me, you know, tell us what you know. They tapped my cell phone. They played back my cell phone conversations. I mean, it was incredible what they did. And they demanded that I confess to all these crimes. And I said, look, I can't confess to crimes I haven't committed. And they said, so be it. And they pulled this tome, this prosecutor pulled this big tome off the shelf, and he read out all the felony charges against me and indicted me right on the spot for perjury, obstruction of justice, and all kinds of crimes. And I was really terrified, but then he said, we are going to lift the indictments to allow you to leave Italy, but they will be reinstated. And so I figured, well, this is just getting me out of Italy. That's what this is. It's kicking me out of the country.
Forever. Well, we're going to take a short break here, and we'll be right back with more fascinating conversation with Douglas Preston.
But first, let's talk a little death, murder, and greed. Those are three great subjects here on this show, because author William Nichol has come out with his latest Jack Farrell adventure in Blood Gold. James Rollins, Thomas Perry, and Sandra Brannan all agree that William Nichol knows adventure. So you need to check out williamnichol.com, N-I-K-K-E-L, for more information about Blood Gold and the rest of the series. Well, when you need to get more than even, that's going to be the question and the answer that Miles Knapp says in his debut thriller, Revenge School. Because David Morrell says fans of Robert Parker is going to love this book. Joseph Fender says a fast-moving tale and an original, appealing voice. So go to RevengeSchool.com now, or you could just be on the list. We want your face. Yep, that's what HorrorSelfies.com wants, is your horror face. Stephen King and more have already shown theirs. So if you love horror, you need to go show it off and send in your photo to HorrorSelfies.com. Brash Books. Well, what do? They just publish the very best crime novels in existence, because with new books by W.L. Whipley in Storm Warning and Mark Smith with The Death of a Detective, they are probably right. So go ahead and check out all their books right now at brash-books.com. Author Jed Power comes out with his latest book in his Dan Marlowe crime series, and that is called Blood On. His books have gotten wonderful reviews, so go ahead and do yourself a favor and go check him out, because the fourth book in the fourth book called Honeymoon Hotel is coming soon. Go to darkjettypublishing.com for more information.
All it takes is the perfect shot. You can take your shot this year in New York City during the 10-year anniversary of Thriller Fest. Take aim during Craft Fest, Pitch Fest, Thriller Fest, and new this year, Career Fest, all designed to help you hit your mark. Meet the pros, like 2015 Thriller Master Nelson DeMille, Silver Bullet recipient Kathy Reichs, with spotlight guests Greg Isles, Charlene Harris, and Mark Billingham. And let the best help you zero in on your career target at the Grand Hyatt in New York City, July 7th through the 11th, 2015. It's time. Take your shot. Register now. www.thrillerfest.com.
Join Stephen King, Peter Straub, Ellen Datlow, Ramsey Campbell, Jonathan Mayberry, and hundreds more in the Horror Writers Association's campaign, HorrorSelfies.com. Take a selfie with any written message promoting reading or with your favorite book. Check in at HorrorSelfies.com to submit your photo, and you can win signed books. Help us let the world know why horror is important and submit your selfie today. That's www.HorrorSelfies.com.
Thank you.
everybody after the break here again on Crime and Science Radio with very special guest Douglas Preston. Again, today's show is called Chasing Monsters, Running from Monsters, an interview with Douglas Preston, who is the best-selling author of the latest book coming out, The Monster of Florence. So now again, here is your host, Doug Lyle and Jan Burke.
Well, welcome back, everybody. We were talking to Doug about his experiences there researching this book and how he ran afoul of the authorities there, particularly McNeeny, the prosecutor. Now, Doug, at one time they got you into an interrogation room, and these guys are pretty good at what they do over there. They were the guys that hammered the mafia, so they know what they're doing. What was the process? What did they do? How's that so different than what we in this country are used to?
Well, that's interesting. I've written a number of novels in which I had, interrogation scenes, and I never understood the kind of psychological terrorism that takes place in an interrogation until it actually happened to me. I mean, I went in there, I'm innocent. I'm a journalist. I felt secure. I'm not a young, uncertain person. But so the chief prosecutor, there were five interrogators, and there was someone taking it all down. There were three cops or three detectives, police captain, and this prosecutor, and the head of this sort of serial killer squad. And it started off very gently, sit down, Mr. Preston, or Dr. Preston, please sit down, are you comfortable? And I thought, oh, this is going to be a piece of cake. So they started asking me a lot of very gentle questions, easy to answer. And I thought, whoa, this is going to be over with so quickly. And then gradually the questions got more and more pointed. And I started getting more and more frightened at the direction these questions were going in. And finally, at a certain point, I stopped and I said, listen, wait a minute. Do you think that I have committed a crime? And the prosecutor stood up and he pointed his fat finger at me. He said, I don't think you committed a crime. We know you committed a crime. We know what you did. Listen to this. And he pressed a button on his computer, and here is my voice coming out of the computer. They had tapped my cell phone calls. And here I am talking about taking a passeggiata, a walk somewhere. And the prosecutor turned to me and said, you talk about taking a walk, this passeggiata. What does this mean? This is code. We know that this is not some walk. We know that this is code. What were you saying? What exactly did you mean? What is this walk you were taking? And I'm like, holy shit. It's just a walk. And he said, don't lie to us, Mr. Preston. We know that you've committed these crimes. And then they went into this whole thing. And, and then they kept, and I started getting confused and I started stammering. And, I'm not totally fluent in Italian, especially, when you're being interrogated like this. And so I'm stumbling over the words. And they kept... They were recording what I was saying, even in the interrogation. And they kept saying, all right, Mr. Preston, you said this, and now you say that, which is true. And I said, well, I'm trying to explain to you. And they said, you say this, and now you say that, which is true, which is a lie, and which is true. And I became completely just, fell apart. I mean, I could hardly think. And... And then they said, these are the crimes you committed, and they accused me of being an accessory to murder, of interfering with a police investigation, of lying or perjury, and it was really frightening. And they said, they demanded that I confess, and Italy has no, Fifth Amendment. They wanted me to confess to these crimes, and the prosecutor said, if you don't confess right here, right now, we will indict you for these crimes. And, I said, I'm not going to confess to crimes I didn't commit. But I was so, reduced to, such a psychological wreck at that point that I could easily see how someone would have confessed to a crime just to get it to stop. Yeah, I did. Yes, yeah. Maybe you're right. Maybe you're right. Oh, and the other technique that they used, which was really interesting, and which I think they used on Amanda Knox, is they said, well, they kept claiming that I committed this crime. And I said, no. And they said, well, all right, you didn't commit the crime. You say you didn't commit it, but if you had committed it, how would you have done it? And I saw that that's a trap. I said, look, I'm not going to, you know, go there. And they said, no. But I mean, if you say you didn't do it, but if you did do it, how would it have happened? I mean, and then they tried to get me to speculate about how I might have committed the crime, which is exactly what they did later with Amanda Knox, and managed to extract not a confession, but a kind of a compromising statement out of her, because they kept asking her to speculate. How might it have happened? If you were there, what might you have seen? And in Italian, those that the might have, the conditional, the subjunctive, are very difficult tenses. And so you often find yourself not responding in the correct tense, but even going into the present tense or something. So in essence, you confess to the crime. Instead of saying, well, I might have done this, you say, I did this, because it's an easier tense.
Wow.
Now, you know, it's so interesting, as you're mentioning, this is the same prosecutor in the Meredith Kircher murder case, correct? He's the same person that
exactly.
was interrogating you. So since you have the experience with him, and I'm, as you were talking just now, I was thinking, you know, it's sort of one thing to be a middle-aged man who may at least have some notion of where the quicksand may be, and she's a 20-something, I guess, at this time, a young woman, perhaps, you know, not quite so sure or aware, and also dealing with the murder of someone she knows. So since you have a background with him, what's your take on the way he approached that case, and including his handling of the DNA evidence?
Did we lose you, Doug?
We might have lost Doug.
I think we might have lost him. He still shows as being on, but he maybe is off right now. So go ahead and continue, and we'll get him back on when he comes on.
did you hit the mute button? Oh, sorry. We've done this before, haven't we, Jan?
Yes, we have.
You know, Oliver Burke was the first one to go off the air. Now, maybe the snow finally caught up to him in the Northeast. I don't know.
No. Well, I think, you know, most people who have paid any attention to that case understand that some similar things happened to her, that she...
Right.
And the young man that she was with were placed in this kind of grilling system. One of the things that Doug had mentioned to us on the break is that the Italian justice system is pretty much based on what Mussolini established in the 1930s. So it's a very fascist-based justice system that still, you know, carries over. The American notion of innocent until proven guilty, it's the Napoleonic system where one has to prove one's innocence.
Right.
So you're in the position of proving a negative, which, you know, prove you didn't do it is a lot harder, to go for than, you know, we must prove you did. So the burden is on the accused.
Yeah, and that is the Napoleonic system. They use it in Russia and Spain and Italy, and there's several other countries that do. I think they actually use it in Louisiana. I'm not sure. But
someone from Alabama would make fun of Louisiana.
But you are guilty until you can extract yourself and prove that you are innocent. And, again, you get a 20-year-old girl, and And if we get Doug back, he'll tell you he was in the interrogation room for 3 or 4 hours. Amanda Knox was in there for nearly 20 hours undergoing this same thing by this same guy.
Right.
Who has been prosecuted himself for prosecutorial misconduct, and I think he dodged a lot of that, and then was reinstated, and then I think they were refiled, and of course Amanda Knox's case has gone right and left and right and left, and you know,
hey,
they
Doug
overturned
Jan.
The conviction, they reconvicted her, and et cetera, et cetera.
Hey, Doug and Jan.
Yeah.
I think we spoke a little too soon. I believe that the Italians might have got him again, but
yeah.
He has escaped Italy again, and he's back on the air. So
all right.
Back on.
All right. I'm afraid I'm talking to you now from a jail cell, but everything's cool. We can finish the interview.
Well, that's a long arm of the law, I'll tell you.
Yeah, that is.
Well, it's funny because Mario Spezza, you know, when I was with him, he kept telling me, Doug, you know, they're tapping your cell phone. And I'm like, what kind of paranoia is this? This is hysterical paranoia. I was sure that they were not tapping my cell phone. And then, boom, you know, I go into this interrogation, and here they are. I mean, my voice was clearer on their intercept than it was on my original crappy cell phone call. But I missed a little bit there, so if I start repeating what you've already told the audience, cut me off. But I was saying that the Amanda Knox case is connected with the Monster of Florence in this way. The prosecutor Magnini, after I was expelled from Italy, he arrested Mario Spezza and accused him of being the Monster of Florence. Now, it sounds incredible, but that's what happened. And Spezza was thrown in prison, and I was back in the United States, and I raised holy hell, and, you know, it was a three-week kind of ordeal for him in prison, but there was an international uproar, and the Italians were forced to release him. And the prosecutor, Magnini, was indicted for abuse of office.
Right.
And so he was under indictment, but still operating as a prosecutor when the Amanda Knox case fell into his lap. And he saw this as his redemption. He was, and also he's very pissed off at the Americans, right? All, you know, but he saw this as a way to redeem himself. So the huge team, a special squad came up from Rome and all this stuff, and they arrested Amanda Knox and her boyfriend after 3 days. You know, they interrogated them. They interrogated her for 14 hours, much worse than what they did to me. And they got her to make these compromising statements. They arrested her. They had this huge press conference saying they found the murderers, Amanda Knox, her boyfriend, and this third person. And then they analyzed the crime scene. I mean, well, they were analyzing it all along, but it took a while for the results to come in. And the crime scene was completely covered with the DNA of an unknown fourth person. His handprints, his fingerprints and her blood on the walls, his DNA inside the victim, his DNA everywhere. Amanda Knox's DNA was not there, nor was her boyfriend's DNA at the site. And the third person they arrested had an ironclad alibi. He'd been bartending, and there were like 15 people who swore he was bartending all night. So Magnini realized that his career would be over if this famous, you know, case, this American girl who'd been arrested, who was on the front page of the New York Times, they had to release her and say that she wasn't the murderess. So they've concocted a case where they found this fourth person. They found him in Germany. They brought him back. He is the murderer. And concocted this whole story about how the three of them, Amanda Knox, her boyfriend, and the real murderer, all did it together in a kind of sexual, you know, satanic conspiracy. And
he has
that's
the
what
devil
they've been
worship
pushing
thing
ever
going,
since.
Doesn't he?
What's that?
He has the devil worship thing going. Doesn't he? Like, we even see this in American cases sometimes where you see the people who have no other theory of the case, so they come up with something about satanic worship.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
wild.
It's It is crazy, and Italy is rife for that. I mean, it's so interesting because I have many Italian friends, and I talk to them about the ridiculousness of satanic worship and, you know, black masses, and they're like, "What do you mean? That's very common. It happens all the time." And I say, "Show me one case in Italy where someone's been convicted of that." Well, you know, it's really hard to convict them, and you know, they're very clever and they've managed to escape conviction. But yes, it's very common. So Italians have this idea, even though it's a country that is, it's a Catholic country, but 90% of Italians don't go to church, but they still have a very, you know, kind of religious mindset and still, you know, feel that the devil is out there and that there are all these cults and, you know, devil worshippers and Satan walks the land. I mean, it's very interesting.
So now how do they try to fit the DNA evidence into this? Just by building a story around it, essentially, you're saying? Or?
Well, they did. I mean, there's a huge amount of evidence in that case. But the essential fact is that the scientific results were fraudulent. They were concocted or ginned up in order to meet the requirements of the prosecution. And this is not something that just happened in the Amanda Knox case. In Italy in general, you know, when the defense presents its forensic evidence for analysis, the labs always find for the defense. And when the prosecution presents their forensic evidence to a lab, the lab always finds for the prosecution. Whoever is paying their bill gets what they want. And this is how Italy works. And in the Amanda Knox case, the judge in the trial allowed the prosecution to have all this forensic evidence analyzed, the DNA and all the rest of it, and did not allow the defense to have any of that evidence analyzed. Now, in the United States, it's you know, a very important part of our system that the defense and the prosecution both get independent scientific analyses. It's absolutely required. But in Italy, it's not required. The judge said that the prosecution could have their labs and analyze the evidence, and the defense wasn't even allowed to look at the lab reports, the basic lab reports. It said, exactly what they did and how many runs and all the rest of it. When those lab reports finally came out in the retrial, the scientific analysis of them showed that they were fraudulent, that the lab had committed fraud and found DNA evidence where there was none. Mm-hmm. They found the DNA of a rye plant and claimed it was Amanda Knox's DNA.
Amazing.
I mean, it was a red knife. It was used to cut rye bread.
I suppose you haven't heard about the devil's ability to change himself into rye bread.
which the mold on it, probably what's called the Salem witch hunt.
Well, so to switch gears a bit, while you worked at the American Museum of Natural History, you and Lincoln Child began writing thrillers together. How did that partnership come about?
Well, I was working at the museum, and I was writing a column in the magazine about the museum. They had a magazine they published called Natural History. And I got this call, this very distinguished voice said, "This is Lincoln Child. I'm a senior editor at St. Martin's Press, and would you like to meet for lunch at the Russian Tea Room? I'd love to discuss with you the possibility of writing a book about the museum." So I rushed out to the Salvation Army and bought myself a jacket so I could get into the Russian Tea Room. And I arrived for lunch, and I was expecting some old, distinguished editor. But here's this kid with ears that stuck out kind of waving at me. He was younger than I was. And so he asked me to write a book for them, St. Martin's Press, and I wrote it. It was my first book called Dinosaurs in the Attic, and it was a history of the Museum of Natural History. And when the book was published, Lincoln said to me, "You know, Doug, this is incredible. All these behind-the-scenes storage rooms, you know, I'd like to see some of these places, like the dinosaur bone storage room or the this or that." And I said, "Well, Lincoln, I don't really have the right to take you into these security areas. I just, you know, I don't have the, you know, I don't have the kind of clearance. But I did have a key. I had a, honestly, you know, it was the weirdest thing. I because I was writing for the magazine, I'd gotten a bunch of keys, and one of them was like a master key to the museum. Not totally master, but if I stuck it into a lock, about 25% of the time it would open that lock. And most of the storage rooms it would open. So I said to Link, look, why don't you come late at night, and we'll do a tour late at night when no one is around and I won't get caught, and we'll just look at some of these storage rooms and I'll take you through some of the darkened halls. And so I did that, and he turned to me, and about 2 o'clock in the morning in the Hall of Dinosaurs, and he said, holy, I mean, Jesus Christ, this is the scariest building in the world. We have to write a thriller set in this building. And I said, okay. So we wrote The Relic.
So the Aloysius Pendergast series, tell us about him and how you developed him.
Well, that was, he appeared in The Relic. And what happened was Lincoln, you know, said, write the first few chapters. In the beginning, I wrote most of the first drafts, and then he'd rewrite because he'd been my editor and I'd been the writer, so that was kind of how it evolved. But so I wrote the first 5 chapters. I sent them to him, and he came back to me and he said, Doug, you know, these are really good chapters, but you got these two cops. There's like an Irish cop and an Italian cop, and they're both like the same character. You know, we need a detective, someone totally different, someone no one has ever thought of before. And I was really irritated by this point at the fact that he didn't like my two cops. So I very sarcastically said, oh, yeah, I know exactly. Yeah, we need like an albino from New Orleans, right? You know, and Lincoln, there was a silence, and he said, you know, Doug, you know, we can work with that. Let's work with that. I mean, Pendergast is not an albino, of course, but he's just very, very pale. So that's where he came from.
Spoken like a true editor.
Well, what's the latest in that series? Tell us about it.
Well, we just published a book called Blue Labyrinth, and well, let's see. It opens with the doorbell ringing at Pendergast's house in the upper west side of Manhattan, upper Manhattan, on Riverside Drive. They answer the door, and someone has deposited a body on the doorstep, and it's someone that Pendergast knows and is very close to. And it seems that he's been murdered, and it seems that the murderer is sending Pendergast a message. But what message? There are no clues at all with the body, except in the stomach they find a piece of turquoise that they're able then to, because turquoise is a mineral that has very, very, you know, complex chemistry in it. They're able to trace this type of turquoise to an abandoned mine in California near the Salton Sea. And so Pendergast decides he has to go to this mine and, you know, see what's there. He realizes that a trap has been set for him, so he's going to go to this mine and try to trap the people who are trying to trap him. And he fails at that, and a disaster occurs, and that's how the novel opens.
Oh, I like it. Well, you do a lot of incredible research, and you wrote actually a wonderful book, Cities of Gold, and about Coronado's search for the 7 cities of Sabala and all of that. Through all of that, you and your photographer wandered around, followed Coronado's route on horseback, which I bet was an adventure in and of itself. But what's the coolest or oddest thing that you ran across while you were doing the research on this famous 7 cities?
Well, I was at the New York Public Library, and I was going through these old, they have actually the original documents from the Coronado expedition in New York, and And I was reading these Spanish, you know, art documents, and they're very dry, they're very legalistic, and I thought, you know, this is not the story. I mean, this is information, but it's not the story. The story is to get out there and really find out what it was like. So being a complete dude, I, you know, got another friend, and we decided we were going to get on horseback, and we were going to retrace 1,000 miles of Coronado's route across of all of New Mexico and Arizona and so forth. And but he didn't, you know, not following any trails or roads or anything. I mean, he just cross-country riding through 9 Indian reservations.
Wow.
And but so I guess the most interesting thing was just about killing myself in this totally crazy, you know, adventure.
Well, I admire your perseverance and focus, if nothing else. Well, Doug, as always, every time we get together, I really enjoy talking with you. You're such a bright, funny person. And this has been wonderful,
great.
And we appreciate it so much.
Well,
thanks,
you. You're great hosts. You got a great show here, so I'm very honored to be on.
Well, thank you for being here. And we'll see you all next time on Crime and Science Radio.